I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Sally Bingham. She is an author, activist, feminist, philanthropist, and she is being honored this coming Friday, the 13th of December. It's called A Sparkling Celebration Honoring Sally Bingham, a Woman of Letters and Learning. It's at the La Posada Ballroom at 6 o'clock, and it's sponsored by the New Mexico Committee of the National Museum of Women in the Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm delighted to be here.
And congratulations on this honor.
Thank you.
It's interesting to be honored at a time in your life when you have been a writer for many decades. You started off when you were just a kid, really.
Yeah, I did. I started writing really as a child. I wrote ghost stories and made my elementary school classmates perform them, which I don't think they enjoyed that much, but I did. And then I went on to get a lot of mentoring from my father, who was very interested in me becoming a creative writer, and then went on and in college took writing courses and got launched with my first published book a couple of years after I graduated.
It's interesting that in the time when you were a young person, your father was so interested in having his daughter become a writer.
It was so I wouldn't be a journalist.
Why was that?
Because in those days that was for boys.
And he was a newspaper person.
Yeah, he owned a newspaper in Kentucky.
Were you in danger of becoming a journalist?
No, because I never was interested. But also, I knew from early that my three brothers were designed to go into newspaper business. So there really wasn't any, never would have been any opportunity for me. And also, I'm not that interested in journalism. I'm much more interested in what we call creative writing.
Why is that?
I'm not certain that I believe in facts. I'm much more convinced that the work of the imagination has some validity, and because we understand that facts are as subjective as anything we do with our imagination, I don't like putting the kind of weight on them that journalism does. I mean, we see it all the time. You know, you read headlines and that's not what the story is about, and there's a whole other story that isn't even included.
Although there is something to be said for getting it right.
If it is ever gotten right.
So you went to college and became a creative writer while you were there, and then when you got out had kind of an amazingly early career getting your books published in a way that would probably be the envy of any 24-year-old starting out today as
Absolutely.
A novelist.
Absolutely. I didn't realize at the time how lucky I was. But I certainly have realized it later because Houghton Mifflin was a very fine publisher in Boston where I was living. And I had an editor there, Ann Barrett, who really believed in my work and knew that I was getting started and that it was going to be a while probably before I could fulfill my three-book contract. I actually ended up breaking the three-book contract because I didn't understand how valuable that was to me. And I felt I should go to New York and align myself with a New York publisher, which I did, but I would have done better in hindsight to stay with Houghton Mifflin, where I had this strong personal connection. I was also publishing stories in the Atlantic Monthly in Boston. I published four stories in a couple of years, and that was also a really important and precious start.
What were some of the themes that interested you early on?
Hypocrisy and loneliness.
And where did that come from?
Childhood, like everything else. In those days, if you grew up in a very conventional family, as I did, you early became aware that there were other stories boiling just under the surface and that the people that were supposed to be admired probably had no reason to be admired, and the people who were despised had no reason to be despised. This was the racist South, so there was all of that going on. So that's where I became very aware of hypocrisy, of how much lying good people do to keep things afloat. And also because I was a very lonely child growing up, I became aware of the fact that many, many people in this culture are deeply lonely. Not because they don't know anybody or they don't have any friends, but because it's so hard for us as human beings to connect on anything more than a superficial level.
You talk about hypocrisy in terms of race, and I have become convinced that race is really the central narrative of our nation.
Absolutely.
What did that look like for you growing up, really in the pre-civil rights era?
Right, yeah, it was. Well, I was really raised by African Americans. That was typical of the South in those days because the well-off white parents really didn't devote much time or attention to their large families. They had a lot of children and then turned them over to the black people who were working for them. So I early felt a strong connection with those women, much stronger than I felt with anybody that was related to me biologically. And it came as a great surprise to me to realize that as I got to be a teenager, they were not really allowed to maintain a close connection with me. They had to start calling me Miss Sally. And that marked a real line of demarcation, whereas before that I had felt as though I was really akin to them. After I was 12 or 13, I realized that was just not going to be permitted.
There's a very poignant story that you tell on your website, which has a kind of lovely sort of self-deprecating narrative that you've written about your life, or at least that's the way it read to me, but how when you were married, this woman who raised you, wedding present was shoved to the back of the table behind it, when she gave you a toaster, and it was shoved behind the crystal and silver, and somehow that's just symbolic of the whole thing.
It is, it's symbolic, and I knew that it hurt her feelings, but I couldn't bring myself at age 21 to say, we have to put the toaster in front.
Right. Now, you married early and often.
Yes, indeed. The only way to do it. If you're going to marry early, you at least should marry often, in my opinion.
Was there a lot of pressure to get married at a young age?
No, there really wasn't, because unusual for that time, my father really expected me to have a professional career, but I had no money. And I didn't know that eventually I was going to inherit some money. So I really was perturbed graduating from college because I knew starting out as a writer, even with an early start, I wouldn't be able to make enough money to live on it. And I didn't want to go to graduate school. I didn't want to teach. And so I was really driven in a way that's kind of unbelievable now by pure financial necessity.
So getting married was an economic decision.
Oh, yeah. Now, love came into it, too. You know, it wasn't purely predatory. But I don't believe I would have gotten married if I had known that within the next 5 years I would inherit some money.
Very interesting. Now, you then started juggling writing, child-rearing, marriage, and just surviving.
Yes.
What was that like?
Really difficult. Really difficult. And I know we talk about this all the time now, but I had 3 small boys and also was coping with a divorce in there. And it really is extremely hard to organize a working life, even a freelancer's life, which is much easier because you don't have to go to an office and you make your own hours. But even so, I remember writing a little essay for a magazine about the clear distinction between writing and taking care of a sick child, and that if one of the boys had a bad cold or something, there was just no way that I was going to close myself up and go on writing. It just wasn't even an option, I felt. And I think a lot of women are very torn in that way between serious professional obligations and serious obligations to their children. I don't know that it can be resolved. Of course, if we had state-funded child care in this country, would make a huge difference.
And if there were some way that men would take on the urgency of a sick child at home in the same way that women did, I don't know if there's a biological component to that that can't be overcome or what's going on there. But
there's something very strange there. I don't know if it's changed to some degree today. I think it may have changed. But in the old days, there was really a line drawn, and the father would come in and sort of give a pat and say hello and how are you and then be gone. And it even, you know, showed in the way men were dressing, because men were dressing in suits and ties and so on, and they were clearly not dressed to be taking care of a child that might throw up on them.
Right. It's funny because it's not a situation in which anybody really wins in the long run. I was reading one of those little sort of articles that comes up on Facebook or whatever, but it was by a nurse who had worked with dying patients for so long that she came up with a top five list of things that people regret when they're on their deathbed. And one of them was, and this was particularly from men, I wish that I had spent more time with my family.
Yeah.
I didn't really even see my children grow
yeah.
up. And when it all comes down to it, oh, and I think the heading of that one was, I wish I hadn't worked so much.
Yes.
And I think there's probably women who wish they'd worked a little more.
Yes, indeed, because I was very aware in the 60s, before the women's movement really bloomed again in the 70s, of how many stay-at-home mothers were really depressed because the world just closed in.
Now, you read The Feminine Mystique when
yes.
it came out, which I believe was in the early 60s, 1963.
Yeah, it was early 63, yeah.
And Betty Friedan wrote that book that was aimed toward really your demographic,
mm-hmm.
middle or upper middle-class white women
right.
in America, who all had this thing in common, which was that they identified something called, in capital letters, the problem.
That has no name.
Nobody could articulate what it was until
yeah.
that book came out.
Yeah, because we felt, and it was right to feel, that if you're comfortably off and you have a husband who's supporting you, that you shouldn't be complaining. But the fact of the matter is, that's no kind of a life. You don't have to worry about paying the bills, but you have a lot of other things to worry about, like whether you're really contributing anything to the world around you.
Right. We're talking to Sally Bingham. When you read that book, and I mean, a lot of people were reading it, and it was not only that book, but there was a whole new consciousness that was beginning to arise. How did you respond?
I was so relieved because it took some of my loneliness away. To understand that there were other women who were going through the same kind of struggles that I was going through. So I was very relieved. I was also somewhat frightened, because one thing that Betty did was to really lay out for us our choices. It's no longer possible just to say, well, I must do this, because this is the way it's always been done. We really would have to begin to take some responsibility for our choices.
And what did that look like?
It looked like drawing some lines, making some boundaries. You know, I'm not available 24 hours a day. I'm going to have at least 3 hours in the morning when nobody bothers me, assuming nobody's sick, when nobody bothers me, and everybody in the household has to begin to accept that, which was very difficult because it was not something that either my husband or my children had ever encountered. It was like, what is this crazy business?
So you got pushback.
Yeah, a lot of pushback. And the other thing that happened, which I had not done before, was that I became very close to a group of women because we were all doing the same thing. And it's infuriating now to see the way the women's movement of the 1970s is disparaged, because it's hard to make this sound as serious as it was. I remember when we all took off our bras. Now, we didn't burn them. Nobody ever burned them. That was a canard. But it was an immense liberation. I mean, if you've ever gone without a bra, it feels very different.
Well, especially those pieces of architecture that they were wearing.
Yes,
at that time.
You know, with these big cones and everything. So things like that were really exciting, really new. Any big change in the culture is very exciting. In fact, it was probably one of the most exciting periods of my life. And I joined a consciousness-raising group in New York, and we were doing some really extraordinary things. And it's hard, I think, for people now to realize how segregated women had been. It really was true that if you went somewhere for dinner, the women would talk to the women and the men would talk to the men.
Right.
And it was incredibly inhibiting, that kind of segregation. And that all began to shift.
What were some of the actions that you guys did together? I mean, consciousness raising was partly really just talking and telling your stories to
yes,
each other.
Yes, yes, yes. And that, too, was very empowering because nobody was interested in those stories. They weren't being written anywhere. So even though they were all familiar stories, they were all pretty much the same, it was still very liberating to have somebody want to listen. And I went to my first big march on Washington. I think it was 1965. And that was, again, a revelation because I had never been part of any political activity, any organized political activity. I came from a liberal family, but, you know, that doesn't really have a great deal of meaning. It's just people who believe certain things but don't necessarily act on them. So that was exciting to see that huge group of women in Washington and feel the fervor and the excitement of that march. Really extraordinary. It also, I always remember it because it was the first time I had dinner in a restaurant by myself, because that was a big issue for us. You know, we were all in our mid to late 20s and we didn't go out to dinner alone.
That kind of thing still happens in Latin America. I spent some time in Peru, and a woman there who was older, she was in her, 60s at that time, said, "No voy a salir sola a la calle. I'm never going to go out of the street by myself. Are you kidding?" I said, "Why don't you get out of the house from time to time?" Because she was going nuts inside the house. Just have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Can't do that. And that was true to some degree in this country, too, not to quite that degree. And even today, I notice, now that I'm single again, that women generally seem to go out either in small groups with other women or with men. You still don't see very many women eating alone in restaurants at night.
Well, it's not that much fun.
No, well, I think it's great fun. You get to look at everybody.
Now, how did all of this find its way into your work? How did your work change as the times changed and your participation in these political movements and feminism? How did it show up?
It really did show up. It showed up in the choice of the characters I was creating to write about. I had gotten, in fact, my father had once criticized me for the fact that so many of the stories in my first three collections were about women who were suffering from depression. Because I was suffering from depression. Well, that is a dead end. You know, you can't go on diving deep into depression and really have anything much worth saying. So I began to write about fighters. And it was much more energizing than the kinds of voices I had chosen before that. I remember a story I wrote in the late 60s called Rachel's Island that was in my second or third collection, I can't remember which is told from the point of view of a young man who goes to visit his sister-in-law at a summer resort, and he thinks he's going to seduce her, and she's just not interested. And he's quite astonished because he's never had that kind of reaction from a woman. And it's actually quite funny because he's so amazed that any woman could turn him down. So that was what I began to write about, the women really pushing back.
And I imagine that, to a greater or lesser extent, all those kinds of incidents were taken from things that you'd observed, either in your own life or somebody else's.
Yeah, I'm a great observer. I love observing, and often it's just a tiny detail. It's not, you know, seeing the whole story laid out. It's the way someone uses his hands. It's the way a woman pushes back her chair. You know, some tiny detail that will spring a whole short story. Novels are different, but for short stories, it's often a tiny detail. Like a story I wrote when I had first moved here in 91 called Apricots, that's about a woman who's a teacher and has an apricot tree in her yard. And she has to get someone to help her pick the apricots. So, you know, that all of that is for me was a great expansion of the world. I also almost completely stopped writing about the South.
Interesting.
I felt as though that was drained. I had written a lot of short stories about the South. It was also beginning to be out of date because I hadn't lived in the South now for a long time. And it also just wasn't very interesting anymore.
And so what did you start writing about? New
Northeast,
York?
Yeah. Big city life, yeah.
Do you feel like you really became a Northeasterner?
I thought I did. Now, as soon as I moved out here in 91, I realized that I've always been a Westerner.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do feel that profoundly. When I was a child growing up in Louisville and we were being driven to school, there were grade crossings, and we'd stop for these long freights, and there'd always be several cars that said Santa Fe on them. And I was just intrigued by that. What was that word? I didn't know what that meant or where that was, but I was always intrigued by that.
We're talking to author Sally Bingham. Now, besides doing fiction writing, you were also doing theater, and it's quite amazing. I mean, you would write a play and it would get produced.
Yes, that was the early 80s. And the thing that had changed in New York in the 80s, and I don't really know why, but suddenly there was a lot of interest in women playwrights and women directors, which has certainly not been true in New York theater. It's decreased again. But I think we went up from something like 9 or 10% of women being produced in New York to about 15 or 16%. And part of that was the theater that I helped to found, the Women's Project, which was devoted to plays written by women and directed by women. And that was a wonderful collaboration. I enjoyed that so much with Julia Miles, who was the original director, the original executive producer, I should say, and Joan Vail Thorne, who was directing and directed, I think, three of my plays. And it was an opening up. It was a possibility. And I've always tried to go where there is possibility. That closed down by the early 90s. It was finished.
What do you mean?
Well, there just wasn't the opportunity anymore.
For women playwrights.
Yeah, we went back to, 11% rather than 15 or 16%.
What?
Isn't that unbelievable?
I think one thing that happens, and I don't think there's anything wrong with saying this, is if you've got a group of people, whether it be women or whatever group that's been oppressed, of which we have many in this society, and then that group decides to empower itself through various political means, including the arts, it takes a while for the quality of that work to actually reach a quality where it is equal to the mainstream, but it does. It always does.
Well, I have a little bit different opinion of that. I think sometimes the first work is the best because it's in terms of the theater, it's where women playwrights first begin to take risks. And later, as the very commercial economy of the New York theater begins to wear in on us, we tend to get a little bit more timid. So I actually thought those plays that were being written and produced in the 80s were more interesting than what I now and then get to see in New York now.
And so women playwrights are once again a lower percentage, and those voices are heard, but not so much.
Yeah. And part of that is because there are very few women producers. And there is one very well-known, well, more than one, probably three well-known women producers in New York, but they're not much interested in work by women. And I think that's often true when you get a women rising to the top in a profession. Those are not the women who are going to be interested in empowering other women because they're not secure enough yet. That'll be the next generation, I hope.
Right. Has that next generation shown itself to have taken that next step?
No. But on the other hand, I don't think there are any younger women who are producing. It's so commercialized. It's so expensive that to try to get the kind of funding that you need is just extremely difficult.
Now, you've chosen lots of different themes in your drama and fiction work, including Madame Blavatsky.
Yes, that was my last play.
Who was she? Why did you write about
her? Well, I was at that point living with a man who was a theosophist, and this being Santa Fe, people will probably know what that is.
Some people will. But
some people
will. It's kind of losing its... that's the kind of thing I would read about in college while studying art history.
Yes, but it's not very much pursued now, I don't think. She was a 19th century Russian mystic. And she started what she called the science of all religions, and at one point came to New York and started a group there. And I was fascinated by her because she was a big, powerful, 200-pound woman who also did what we would call magic tricks, made things disappear and so on. So it was a very different kind of character from anyone I'd written about before. Unfortunately, you can't really do tricks on the stage because the stage is all illusion anyway. So, you make a teacup disappear, and it's perfectly clear how that's happening on the stage. So it didn't really work very well. And also, audiences are very uninterested in big women. I don't think there's ever been a play that worked that had a 200-pound lead figure.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever happened. There are big women in opera, or used to be big women in opera.
Oh, there still are.
And still are, but not in the theater. And now I notice even with concert musicians, they're all starting to look the way movie stars look, and it seems as though it's no longer enough to be a very talented musician. You also have to look a certain way.
We're talking to Sally Bingham. So what happened next? You were first in Kentucky, then you were in New York, you were getting married and divorced, you were raising children, you were a successful writer. Did you feel like a successful
writer? No. Well, first of all, once I had three children, I really was not publishing. I was still writing, but I couldn't keep up with the business of publishing. So there was a long gap between my first three books and the books that came afterwards, a long gap. And as we know, if you don't have a book out in every 2 years or so, you don't really exist as a writer in the mind of the public.
Yeah.
I existed for myself as a writer, but that was all. And also, it was a bad time in New York for women writers. It was the big bulls were roaring around like Norman Mailer, and really hard to get any kind of hearing, really hard. So it was very discouraging because I'd moved to New York really for my career as a writer. And probably the main reason why I left New York in the 80s was that I just realized I couldn't really get ahead there. I didn't feel it was ever going to work.
Little did you know at the time it was going to happen, but you came into an inheritance. How did that change your life?
Well, I didn't really inherit anything. In fact, I was disinherited. But that's a long, complicated story. In the late 80s, my father, who was the owner and publisher of a newspaper in Kentucky and a printing plant and a television station and radio station, a monopoly in that state, decided that he wanted the women in his family to serve on the board. Up until then, it had only been the men in the family. And he was something of a scamp. And I think he was bored, and he thought, let's just make an explosion here. It'll be more interesting.
He just was a troublemaker.
Yeah. So it did make an explosion. Suddenly there were these five women on the boards who were outspoken and smart and raising questions that nobody had raised before. And it was not well tolerated at all.
What kind of questions were you raising?
Oh, I remember this was in the 80s when $1 million was really $1 million. And one of the executives said very casually that they had bought this traffic helicopter. It was the beginning of all that. But it didn't really work, and they just got rid of it and lost $1 million. And it seemed very casual. And I was kind of horrified. I thought, you know, that's a lot of money to lose on something that didn't work out, and nobody could really explain why it didn't work out. So that's the kind of question that I would be raising. And it's perfectly legitimate. It's what boards should do. But these old-time, male-dominated corporate boards are basically social events. You know, you have few figures rushing by on the screen so fast you can't read them, and then a big lunch and a lot of cocktails, and
right. That's
the board meeting.
And it also illustrates something that I think is important that people kind of forget about, which is that a lot of the time what one group accuses another group of is actually their problem. So a lot of, in those days especially, a lot of men accused women of being kind of flighty with money and
yes.
just going out and spending hubby's money
yes.
with the credit cards and all of that, whereas
yeah.
actually women were the ones who were keeping the family budget
exactly.
together, who
exactly.
were looking to see whether a board was spending $1 million on something that didn't work and so on. And we're actually really good at that.
Yeah, we're very good at it. We're good at figures. We're very practical. We know when something doesn't make sense. Often we're not quite as preoccupied with status. And it was also when women were beginning to speak out all over the country. We weren't the only ones. There were women finally getting into positions of power and asking questions that made the men who'd been there forever uncomfortable.
I can't help but think, I mean, every time we talk about Social Security and health care and so on, how many weapons that don't work are we continuing to manufacture every day?
Every day. We've gotten sort of blunted to it. Nobody really seems to object anymore when you hear about one of these useless fighter planes that's cost millions of dollars and it's never going to fly because it has some basic flaw.
Right.
And nobody's thinking about what that's doing to our economy, because how can we ever develop any forms of clean energy until we divert some of that money?
So meanwhile, you got on the board. A lot of kerfuffle ensued. What happened next?
three years of arguing and fighting and memos and lectures and executives taking me to lunch and saying, you've really got to shut up. We don't want to hear anything from you anymore. And my mother and my sister and two sister-in-laws were also on the board. So, you know, they were getting some of the same treatment. Finally, my brother, who was the publisher, decided that all the women should resign. And I didn't see any reason to resign. The others did resign, so I was left in this perilous position of being the only woman left, which, of course, made everybody furious. And eventually, after all this wrangling and carrying on, my father, who was the majority shareholder, decided to sell the companies. And it was at the height of the newspaper business. It was really one of the first private newspapers to be sold, privately held newspapers to be sold. So everybody in the family was enormously enriched. And they haven't thanked me yet. And that's 25 years ago.
So what did you mean when you said you were disinherited?
Well, my parents cut me out of their wills. They didn't speak to me again after the sale.
Why was that?
They hated what I had represented, which is an outspoken woman. They hated it.
So until the day they died, they never spoke to me again.
And they also didn't speak to me because I wrote a memoir about the sale, which went into the unexplained death of my step-grandmother, Mary Lily Flagler Keenan Bingham, who was the one who brought the money into the family. And she died 11 months after she married my grandfather, and there was a big case at the time. It was 1917. But it was never resolved, and everybody just sort of forgot about it. And I felt as though she had suffered unjustly, and I wanted to do as much research as I could. There wasn't really very much to research, but do as much as I could and write what her story might have been. And that my mother told me she'd never speak to me again if I mentioned Mary Lily, because it was a big skeleton in the closet. And it was a huge dilemma for me. I knew my mother meant it. She was a woman of her word. She was not going to relent. And it was a huge dilemma. But I knew if I gave in to what was, in effect, censorship, that my career as a writer was really over. Because once you've done that, you can't go on.
So then you were cut off. We're talking to author Sally Bingham from your roots, essentially.
Yes.
You had your children.
Yes, but they were by that time grown and launched into their own lives.
So what did you do?
Left Kentucky. Came out here.
That's when
God.
You came to Santa Fe.
Yeah, in 1991. Yeah, I realized that I would always be a pariah there, and that's a very boring role after a while. So I just decided to buy a pickup. I'd never had a pickup before. Put everything that I wanted in it and just light out for the territory. That's the best thing I ever did.
And you've been here ever since?
Yeah, I've been here ever since.
Now, I have to ask you again, how did being in the West affect your writing?
It was very liberating. I no longer had any reason to worry about what people in my family would think. I don't think they've ever read anything of mine since then. I no longer had a circle of friends from way back who would have their opinions. I was very alone, but on the other hand, being alone really opened up a lot of possibilities for me.
And then, of course, there's a completely different landscape, culture, and way
of
life.
Yes, and as we say, the big sky. There is something about being able to see the mountains and having a far horizon instead of the kind of close horizons that you get in the East that I still find every day really inspiring.
Now, meanwhile, Your kids were grown, you were alone, and you had time, which is the ideal situation for the writer, especially given where you had come from, where you had to carve out those little hours in the morning.
Yeah, the only thing that I then had to deal with was that I began to get very lonely after 2 years. I really didn't know anybody. My big event of the day after I finished writing was to go to, there used to be a Connie's in town, walk to the Connie's and get something for dinner and go back and fix dinner and listen to the news and take a walk, and that was it. And I realized that nobody was going to come and dig me out of that hole. So I had a dear friend in New York who, and we used to complain to each other on the phone in the days when people talked on phones, and she said, we have to take the fun pledge. And I said, what is the fun pledge? She said, well, you have to promise that you're going to have fun. I said, I don't know how to have fun. What would I do?
Really?
Yes. I really didn't, because all I did was work. So
even after all that consciousness raising and all the...
Yeah, but remember, I had pretty much lost that, because here I never found those groups or that kind of support. It probably existed here. It may still exist here, but I didn't find it. So Anne said, well, the first thing you've got to do is take ballroom dancing lessons. And I've always loved to dance. So I went out to the studio on Cerrillos and signed up for lessons and got absolutely involved, deeply involved in ballroom dancing, and started going to competitions and buying all those marvelous clothes and meeting a lot of people. And at the same time, I learned how to ski. I'd never skied in my life. And that also opened a whole world to me. So I was now, once again, not having as much time as I used to have, but it was a much more balanced life. Nobody can just live alone and write every day. It's not very healthy.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about being a writer, is you have to carve out that alone time, and if you have too much of it, you go bananas.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I write... I save my mornings. I never let anything except you intrude on the mornings.
Oh, thank you.
I mean that. But I don't think I can ever again write all day. It just doesn't make any sense. None of us have that much to say. And, of course, a lot of writing is also the business of writing. It's editing. It's keeping up with publishers. It's reading professional journals and so on.
So you... are from the South, and wherever you went and wherever you go, like it or not, you're still a Southern woman.
Oh, no.
You don't think so?
No, I'm a Westerner.
You're a Westerner.
Yeah,
well, I was going to ask you, what is your relationship like with other Southern women? Do you have ties with Kentucky?
My sister still lives there, and I have a niece there, and two grandchildren there now. So I go back several times a year, but I wouldn't say I had ties with Kentucky. I would say I have ties with those women. I also still own a farm outside of Louisville that I've put into conservation easements, so I'm connected with the conservation movement in Kentucky. But in terms of being connected with the whole state or having any sense of allegiance to the state, it's really not there. I'm much more devoted to New Mexico.
You have also become a philanthropist.
Yes. As soon as the sale took place, I realized that for the first time in my life, I had enough money to make significant charitable contributions. And that was a big challenge and a wonderful opportunity. So I started two attempts then, one in Louisville called the Kentucky Foundation for Women. It's 25 years old now, which I endowed. And it makes grants, small grants, $2,000, $3,000, to women writers and artists who are willing to call themselves feminists. Now, over time, the edge has been taken off of that, and they only have to talk about being interested in social change. That was a hard fight. But anyway, that's where it went.
That's a committee meeting that we won't talk about.
Yeah, we won't talk about that. So the foundation gives away about $200,000 a year in Kentucky, and I'm no longer on the board. It was time for me to move on and for the foundation to move on. And then at the same time, I founded an archive for women's papers at Duke University in Durham called the Sally Bingham Archive for Women's History and Culture, also 25 years now. And they collect and preserve and give access to a large archive, a lot of women, not necessarily from the South, a lot of women activists, a lot of the early women's movement groups, like the women's bookstores that used to exist, all those papers are there. And they're used by undergraduates and graduate students at Duke, so they're actually used. They don't just sit in boxes somewhere.
That's always the thing about archives.
I know. It's a problem. People keep things closed up way too long.
And even if they're perfectly accessible to students, who's going to go there and why?
I know. And there has to be some outreach. And we do have some outreach. And we usually have, they hold various seminars and gatherings 3 or 4 times a year. We also give some scholarships. So it's quite well known on the campus. I don't know how well known it is outside of Duke.
We're talking to Sally Bingham. I've heard writers say that there has to be a hunger for them to keep their ambition going. You made this newspaper sale. Suddenly you had more money than you needed. You had enough not only to live but to give away.
Yes.
Did that affect your hunger to be a writer?
Yes, it did. Well, it opened up some more possibilities in terms of what I could write about in fiction. And I started writing about the role of women as givers, which is very complicated because we tend to give too much. And we have some difficulty with saying no. So one of the stories in my more recent collection is called Doing Good, and it's told from the point of view of a woman who goes down to Florida to rescue her adult son who's in trouble and ends up trying to save a young girl who's pregnant and trying to persuade her to get an abortion and so on. And it's all about the ambiguity of doing good, because often when we think we're doing good, we're really just interfering.
Very interesting. And so for women, I mean, what do you think some of the lessons are? You've seen so many different phases of feminism and women's movement and just social change. What do you think if you were talking to a 25-year-old woman or somebody, just a woman who just graduated from college right now, what are some lessons that you would like to tell her that you think might be useful in this age?
Yeah, and actually I have a granddaughter who's a freshman at college, so I'm coming up with that. I think I would really warn them about getting absorbed into the corporate world. There's a lot of money to be had, and women are beginning to rise into positions of power. But I think that world is so corrupting that it's just impossible for a woman to keep any sense of integrity or connection with other women. I also would really focus on women taking care of ourselves, because we tend to work too hard. As you know, we tend not to give ourselves any time off. We tend not to have any fun, take care of our health. And I think that's something we're still learning. It's still hard for women to be really good to ourselves.
It's such a double-edged sword, because I think it's important to learn lessons of humility. I think it's important to learn lessons of giving and not being a big egomaniac and asking for more than is right. And when you're in a first world society, most of us have more than we need at the get-go, which is probably less and less true every day as capital flows upward and wages stagnate and so on. But asking for what you need and not asking for too much, it's kind of a fine line.
It is a fine line. And I don't think we've developed very far in that direction. I'm always struck by the fact that now that we have a larger population of homeless people than we did 10 years ago, how uncharitable we are. You almost never see anyone stop and give a dollar to somebody panhandling. And in fact, as you know, Santa Fe tried to restrict their access to the plaza. We don't seem to have much empathy for people that we feel are different from us, look different, smell different, sound different. And one of the reasons I love my church, St. Bede's Episcopal Church, is that it's the only place where I see people who are clearly different from me. And that's important. We have to break out of our little cocoons somehow. And Santa Fe is very segregated, much more so now than it was 20 years ago. And it's possible just to live behind your gate in your nice, comfortable house and never really be aware of what else is going on in the world. In fact, I've heard people say that they didn't even want to drive to Rodeo Road.
What?
Have you heard people say that?
No.
Yes, though, well, that's unknown territory. I don't want to go out there.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty
amazing.
But
see, what you're saying illustrates, again, that fine line, because a moment ago you said sometimes you give in a way that becomes interfering.
Yes.
And then people aren't giving to panhandlers. Now, if you give to a panhandler, who knows who that person is and what their story is, and if you enter into that story, what are you doing there?
Well, I think you have to allow them their freedom as individuals. We will never know what they do or who they are. All we can know is that they are in need, and that's very apparent. They're in need, and that's as far as we need to go. They're in need, and if we're in a position to help, we should help.
So for young women, be careful of the corporate track.
Yes.
What about marriage and kids?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. And I think we all started, as I did, thinking that we can do it all. I don't know that we can do it all. I think wealthy women who can hire help have a better chance. But even in that case, we're very emotionally bonded to our children. It's just a fact of biology. So even if you are able to afford help, you may not actually be able to bear to separate yourself from a small child. And men have not really filled that gap at all, and I don't think they ever will. So it's much more difficult, and it's going to be hard to manage for women.
Don't say I don't think they ever will.
You think they might?
I do.
Well, I do have one friend who's very devoted to his children. So yeah, it maybe is changing. I just haven't seen very widespread change. But it's probably true that younger men, you know, men who've come up with the women's movement are more likely to understand the contribution they can make to their children.
And to understand the joy of equality.
Yes, exactly.
Now, we've got a few minutes left. You've got a new book that you're working on.
Right. It's coming out in August, next August. It's called The Blue Box, and the subtitle is Three Lives in Letters. It's based on a blue box that was in the top of my mother's closet when she died.
Oh, my goodness.
And in there were all these tied-up bundles of letters going from the early 19th century to the 1930s from my great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my mother, written to various people in the course of their lives when women used to write a lot of letters. So it's really the story of their times, their individual purposes and their times. It's been fascinating because I never had very much American history, and I finally began to learn something about American history, particularly for the Civil War period, because all these women were Virginians, and they were deeply involved in the Confederacy and in belief in that system, which has been difficult to write about. It's been just a great challenge and very exciting. It's ready to go. It's being published by Sarah Band Books.
So we will wait for that and no doubt get you back on the show.
Good.
When that comes out.
I would love to do that.
Sally Bingham is an author, playwright, activist, philanthropist, and this Friday, the 13th of December, there is an event honoring Sally Bingham. It's called A Sparkling Celebration, honoring Sally Bingham, a woman of letters and learning. It's sponsored by the New Mexico Committee of the National Museum of Women in the Arts, and it's at La Posada Ballroom. You can get tickets through the Lensic, 988-1234, and everybody is welcome. Sally, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.